Hello and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast, supporting you on your mothering journey during pregnancy, birth and beyond. Through yoga, education and community, we enable every woman we work with to connect more deeply to herself and her own innate wisdom. Find your tribe as you become a parent, making positive, informed choices that are right for you, because Lush Tums believes everything has a place. Join the two Claires as we connect, laugh and learn. In this space, everything is welcome. Hi, and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast. I'm Claire McGill.
And I'm Claire Maddalena. Today we're joined by Kate Woods. Kate's been a doula for many years, and I had the privilege of doing my doula training with her probably about 10 years ago. Kate's launched several projects since then, including Mother Tongue, Conscious Birthing, Teacher Training, and Doulas Without Borders, and we'd love to talk to her about all things doula today. Welcome, Kate. It's lovely to have you on the podcast. How are you doing?
Hello, Claire and Claire. I'm doing well, thanks. And thanks for inviting me along today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. I've been looking forward to meeting you. Claire's spoken so much about how meaningful your trainings were in her life and all the things she learned from you. So it's really exciting to actually meet the person behind Claire's doula journey. But for people listening, I think there might be some people out there going, what is a doula? So could you start with giving us a little overview of what a doula is? What do you do?
Sure. A doula is someone who offers relationship-based support, information, advocacy, and signposting to anyone who's in the childbearing year. I mean, generally speaking, doulas actually do sometimes support people through the process of dying as well. So we're very much people who stand at the bookends of life and help create ease of transition from one, you know, type of experience to another, i.e. pregnancy to birth, which is the most common, or life to death, which is less common but becoming more so as time goes along. So we're not clinical, we're not medical, we're very much about working with the individual and tailor-making our service to what's going on for them and what they need, and then advocating for them in a time when it might be not that easy for them to speak for themselves. So, yeah, support, relationship-based support, advocacy, education, and, you know, guidance towards their own most empowered experience of whatever they're going through. The birth of my son 26 years ago that created my, you know, brought me into awareness of the fact that that's what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I literally decided that during childbirth. And so I've been in the field for 26 years. I started attending birth soon after he was born with him. So in those days, that was a thing, you know, it was quite normal. It was much less of a formal thing to be a doula, you know, and people would just do it much more informally, which meant that bringing your baby along was fine. And actually, it worked really well. But that's another story. So that's how it all came about, really. It was the experience of childbirth and the recognition that the joy and the power and the sort of transcendental energy behind birth was being hidden from view by the systems that are set up by the institution, by the pharmaceutical industry, by a whole bunch of things that seem to be in the way of this incredible rite of passage. And I was lucky enough to experience it as that and decided that I wanted to spend the rest of my life helping other people to see through all the veils and get to experience the truth of the truth of birth and what it can offer as a, not only as a beautiful experience for the person who's coming earthside, but for the parent and for the emergent family. I recognize that being able to have an empowered birth had a huge impact on life going forward for me, and wanted other people to be able to, I wanted to help people to make steps towards that in whatever way I could, I guess. So it was birth itself that brought me to it.
Wow, that sounds amazing. Could you tell us a little bit about how you were feeling and thinking before you went into labour, and then maybe a bit about that experience? Was it like a kind of thunderbolt of knowing, or just a general feeling? Or I'd love to hear what it was like for you.
Well, one of the things that always sticks out for me about the whole experience was my decision not to become overly educated during pregnancy. So I was living out on the land. I wasn't living in a house. I was living on the land with a whole bunch of people. And I was spending my days making music and painting and walking. So I was really, looking back on it, you know, utilizing the part of my brain that was going to be most used in labor and birth, really, but I didn't know it. I just had a strong instinct that I didn't want to burden myself with too much expectation or other people's views of what birth should or could be. So I avoided it. I did go to an antenatal class once at some point, and the midwife who was running it said, okay, hands up in the room who's going to go for an epidural. And, you know, 3/4 of the people put their hands up. And then hands up those of you thinking about using gas and air. And again, you know, lots of people. And then hands up those of you who are thinking about having, and then she smirked, a natural birth. And me and my friend shot our hands up, and she started laughing. And I thought, you know what, if this is education, then I don't want to be educated. I want to come into it uneducated. I've sort of had this instinct that it was a mammal's job, and, you know, I've never seen a mammal go to an antenatal class before, and I thought, nah, it's not for me. So I stayed really kind of earthed during the whole time and of my pregnancy. And at one point I went for a scan, and I was told that I had placenta previa, and the placenta was going to be in the way, and I'd probably have to have a cesarean section. And I remember thinking, you know, you've got no idea what you're talking about. You know, I just had this sense that it was so early on in the pregnancy, I kind of knew everything would stretch and move. And sure enough, it did. It was fine. So that was very much my build up. It was just I guess my pregnancy was an opportunity for me to come into awareness about just how much I trusted my intuition. And it was the birth of my intuitive self in that regard. You know, I've never looked back. It's just become, you know, something that I trust beyond everything. So that was a good start, I guess. And then the birth itself, well, to be honest, I had a really good time. I thought it was a lot of fun. And I couldn't understand why it had this terrible press, you know, like it was this really hard thing. And, you know, it was even called labor, which I always associate with, you know, hard labor, like, I don't know, just a, it's not a positive word, is it? And so I went into it singing. I was singing to my baby, my boy. It was a really nice sunny day, and I was singing to him. He was 2.5 weeks past the due date, and I was absolutely all belly. And I was thrilled, you know. I had a show, and I was thrilled. But even that made me laugh. The show made me laugh, because I thought, what a name for it, you know, like this kind of show is going to come out. And so I had a lot of joy. I had a lot of singing. I spent a lot of time barefoot outside. I went to a local maternity unit, like a little cottage hospital standalone thing. And I was with my friends outdoors, a beautiful sunny day. And then, yeah, came in, and it was a bit of a thunderbolt of recognition coming into something, and just recognizing the power of it, recognizing that, you know, I think that birth is an opportunity for us to connect with our ancestry, for us to connect with the place in which there is no separation, with creation herself. And it was the most holy experience, I guess, of my life. And you know, it wasn't perfect. They broke my waters without asking. There was meconium, and everybody started running around, and they cut the cord too early. You know, it wasn't perfect, but somewhere within that experience, there was absolute crystalline perfection in my coming into awareness of that place, and meeting my son in that place, and Yeah, it was game changing, really. Sorry, that was like a really long answer, wasn't
All fantastic, and I really felt like I was there with you with that. So thank you so much for sharing. And not everyone does have that kind of experience or clarity around giving birth, but I think those who have experienced it will be shouting yes very loudly and really relating to what you say. If someone hasn't had that kind of experience, I think it's still good to know that can happen and does happen. And there's a whole spectrum of experiences to be had. And generally in our society, we don't get to hear words like holy and sacred around birth. And actually, for some people, that is absolutely their experience, and clearly was for you as well, and gave you that clear drive to go into the work that you've ended up doing. So, where did you go from there?
Well, it's a good question, and I think just to reflect back on what you just said, it does bring to mind something that's quite fundamental, I think, in our field, which is that there is no place for a positive birth story. There is no place for it, Claire. It's really hard to share it because, it's not the cultural experience, it's not the general experience. The general experience and the cultural expectation is one of trauma. And as a result of that, those of us who had really incredible, sort of, I don't know, life-changingly positive moments feel almost embarrassed and hidden. We have to hide that. We have to hide our light under a bushel. And, that's a shame, isn't it? It's a shame because how will the culture ever change if we can't? And yet, by doing it, we're made to feel, there's a hell of a term there, isn't it? But there's a sense of, I don't know, what is it, competition or something in that? And so you hear people talking about their negative birth experiences, almost like, well, I had a worse time than you. And the person who had a positive experience is sitting in the corner just trying to keep their face in their cup of tea. So anyway, it does strike me as quite important for us to share our stories, whether they're negative or positive. So where I went from there was straight into the birth world, really. I was working with the midwife, who was head midwife at the time where I lived in Glastonbury, where I'm still generally based. And she would just let me know when there was somebody who needed a bit of extra support, and I would go along. I didn't, first 10 years, I didn't charge for it. I wasn't being a martyr. I just didn't really think about it, something I could get paid for. And I just went along. It was very old school. I'd go along and be with the person until the midwife turned up, and then after she turned up as well, and my baby would be with me, and oftentimes the labouring mum, the labouring person, would look at me feeding my baby and would just have this very like a sped up the whole labour very much so, because the oxytocin in the room went up, and I think the labouring mum would be like, I want one of those. I want to be doing that. Or that's the outcome, that's the outcome of this. I remember what this is for. So yeah, I was straight into the work, really. And here I am, 26 years on, still in the work.
And has your passion for it grown over time, or how have things changed in 26 years around the birth world? You've seen probably quite a few changes, not only in sort of hospital policy and that sort of thing, maybe as a society. What's your observations been over this time? How's your work differed?
Well, I think we're in a hell of a mess now, aren't we? Let's face it, it's pretty awful, and it's got worse over the pandemic. But in terms of, well, I think the expectations on doulas has increased tenfold, and the need for doulas to be advocates has got much higher. So I think the whole way in which we practice has changed massively as a result of that. The more clinical midwives have become, and the more the system is not meeting the needs of the labouring person and the pregnant and birthing and postpartum woman. As a result of that, the onus on the doula has changed enormously. So I think that's really been interesting and quite heartbreaking in many ways, but powerful for doulas. I think our role has become, whereas our role before was perhaps a wonderful addition in a birth room, I think now it's an essential part of the constellation of people around the labouring and birthing woman. And I mean, in terms of how things have changed in the systems, I mean, it's incredible how much things have changed, really. You know, when I look back, when I first started, we were campaigning for the idea of leaving the cord pulsating after birth. And the medics and the clinicians around us thought we were absolutely crazy to be talking about this. They didn't understand it. And of course, now it's in the NICE guidelines. And then we were suggesting that that birthing people had a vaginal swab put on their chest after, if they'd had a cesarean section birth, emergency cesarean, that they, you know, so babies could pick up this connection again with the mother, with the scent and with the immune boosting factors and whatnot. We didn't even have the name for it then. And of course, now it's microbiome seeding and it's very much a known. So it's been interesting to watch how things have evolved. And in some ways, many positive things have evolved, such as those two. But in terms of the system itself, I think it's cracking. I think the NHS is actually starting to crack. People are being told they can't have home birth and they have to go to hospital. And then in the hospital, they're being told they have to be induced, and they don't understand that that's a recommendation, not an instruction or a demand. And so they're going along with it. People are, you know, being really traumatized, actually, in birth, massively traumatized. And there's a lot of obstetric violence. And I think that the people who work in the systems now are also at effect of great trauma. I think that the organization itself is traumatized, and that we're in a cycle of trauma where, you know, healthcare practitioners are traumatized. They're working with people giving birth who get traumatized, and then that traumatizes the healthcare practitioner even more. It goes around, and it's a real mess at the moment, actually. I mean, one of the positives is we're seeing a lot more people choosing to birth outside of the system, and people who are choosing to advocate for themselves or find an advocate to support them through birth within the system. So positive things are coming out of it, but I think we are in a bit of a mess right now.
How would you see things moving forward? If they're to move forward in a more positive way, what kind of things can we do on the ground? What kind of things could we campaign for the system to do? Where can we take this, Kate?
Do you know, I think probably the most fundamental thing that needs to happen is the people who are working in the systems of care, the people who are working on the ground, you know, going in and doing their shift overnight as a midwife or whatever, need support. They need retraining and they need regrouping and they need support. They are not given anywhere to debrief properly. And the culture in which they do get the slightest bit of support to debrief isn't safe. So I think that the training, midwifery training itself, needs to change. At the moment, midwives are trained so clinically, and their whole focus in their training is around, well, massively around risk assessment and risk management. And if they're lucky enough to go and do a midwifery degree somewhere where physiological birth is much more on the table and much more present in the modules, then they just have a massive shock when they come out of their training and start practicing. As a doula trainer, I'm continuously, finding more and more doulas, more and more midwives, sorry, in my cohorts who have just bottomed out. They can't do it anymore. So I think really it's about repairing the system. And the idea that the system is broken is a bit old hat. I don't think the system is broken. I think the system was created like that, but it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's not humanistic. It's not reflective. It's not co-supportive. One of the things I've done about that in my own career is I wrote a trauma-informed and responsive training, a workshop, and I got it accredited with the Royal College of Midwifery so that I could go in and teach midwives and doctors about how to be trauma-informed and responsive. And actually, one of the things that we do more than anything on that workshop is look at ourselves. Where are we in the cycle of trauma? And how can we learn some practices around self-care and mindfulness and recognition of you know, what it is that we're holding? So I think for me, that's where it's at. It's about compassionate practice and bringing that in to the center of the field, and within the center of that, making it about self. So starting straight away with awareness and mindfulness practices and, peer support, how to create listening partnerships, things like that. Very, very on the ground, relationship-based stuff could really help, I believe.
That sounds like a really proactive way to support the people giving the support. And I suppose that actually fits in with the idea of a doula as well, is like you're there supporting the support around the woman to ensure that she's supported well through her experiences. Do you feel like sometimes there's, you know, in an ideal scenario, doula, midwife, clinicians involved if they need to be, are all working together on the same page? Does that happen often in real life, or do you find that there's nearly always a divide between doula advocating for the wishes of her client and the people providing the medical care?
I think it very much depends, Claire, on each and every situation. It can turn on a penny, really. It depends if what the doula is advocating for on behalf of her client aligns with what the healthcare practitioner believes should happen. And often that is coming from above, you see. So it might even be that the healthcare practitioner themselves is already in conflict because they don't even feel that they want to be saying what they're saying, but they have to say it because they've been told they have to say it. So there's this incredible sort of constellation of energy around the birthing person that is incoherent. And what we know we need during this time is to be able to drop into a trance. And to be able to drop into a trance, we need to be able to turn our alert receptors down, from full beam down, dim the lights internally as well as externally. And that can't happen when there's all of this crossfire. So yes, there are moments of coherence, and yes, there are moments of agreement and peace, but less so than they used to be.
So with our work, we work with lots of pregnant people all the time. They come to the yoga classes and we try and teach them how to drop into that trance, into that inner awareness. I guess if you could have like three things that you could say to someone who was pregnant coming up to their experience to help them have the most empowered and less interfered with experience, what kind of things would you kind of put out on the table as things that they might want to consider and reflect on?
Okay, I would suggest listening to your intuition, but probably first, really doing the work around, you know, it's a soul searching journey, doing the work around your own blueprint, what you came in believing, what your family told you, what your culture says, what your friends are doing in their birthing experiences. How were you born? How was your partner born? Really doing that homework and starting to recognize how we can end up making our decisions and choices around how we hope to labor and birth based on either the story we've come in with or reaction to the story we've come in with. And neither one of those things are particularly useful. So I would say the first thing is to try and really do some homework around that and start asking questions about, you know, how you arrived Earthside and how your partner arrived Earthside. And then starting to make space within that for you to step into your own power and make some decisions and choices that are really based on what's right for you. And that, of course, comes from your intuition. And so anything that can help people move towards an intuitive place is useful. So, you know, the good old where do you feel that in your body techniques work really well. You know, is that coming from your gut? Is that coming from your head? So recognizing where feelings come from in the body can be a useful tether, I think, to help people to start to embody their choices. Yeah, I mean, three things. Gosh, I don't know. I mean, looking at how one experienced menstruation can be really useful, going back and considering, you know, what was my relationship like with my moon time, with my bleeds? You know, did I just reach for paracetamol as soon as I felt sensation, or did I move with it? Did I like a hot water bottle? Did I make noise? Did I like my feet being rubbed? And those sorts of things can really help someone to start to consider what the sensations might be like and how to prepare. So I think all of those things are useful. And then, of course, making a plan, although we don't really like that word. So making, you know, a set of intentions or wishes that are really cohesive and bullet point, because they won't get rid of there too long, but very clear, you know, making those choices in advance about things like examinations and taking space. And so I think that's really key as well. It's about preparing. It's about reflecting back, coming into awareness, anchoring the intuition into the body, and then making plans and preparations from that place with spaciousness around it that allows for, you know, the wild card, because labor and birth can change. But, you know, I think we can birth with love, whatever the form. So really bringing ourselves into our hearts around it and recognizing that it's okay. Whatever happens is okay. We can still birth with love. So that's probably not three things, but that would be, in a nutshell, what I would suggest.
Yeah, that's really brilliant, Kate. Thank you. And I really remember hearing some of the things you're speaking about today coming through in the training that we did, the conscious birthing training. So kind of thinking about your journey with, you know, doing your own doulaing and then taking that into a training and training, I don't know how many people have you trained now in your community, and watching that grow. How has that been for you? Kind of pioneering, you know, training people to be doulas. You were one of the first out there doing it.
It's a lovely part of the work, Claire, I'll be honest. I absolutely love it. I always feel like I'm doulaing doulas. You know, it's an opportunity to doula people into the birth of their own practice, and that's just magic. It really is. And it started as all of this work for me, quite organically. So I just saw somebody was offering a doula training in a university and thought it was a really weird idea. That kind of juxtaposition between the sort of academic and the grassroots lay tradition style of what a doula is. So I phoned her up just because I was being nosy, really, to see how that rolled out and why it was that she'd chosen to train doulas in a uni. And I came off of the phone with a job. She'd offered me to come and teach on this training. And so she offered me this job, and she sent me a list of things. She sent me like the program of what she wanted me to teach on this university doula training. And I looked at it and I had to say, I'm really sorry, but no, I can't do that. That does not feel like anything to do with doula's training to me. It doesn't feel like the essence of what a doula is. It was things like she had on the training, she had data protection and health and safety and a whole bunch of stuff that just didn't feel like the heart of it. Anyway, it was a really positive thing to have happened because it led me to considering what is the essence of being a doula. And so I had to say to her, I'm really sorry. Thank you so much for this amazing opportunity, but I can't do it. Expecting her to say, thanks very much, we'll find someone else. And she said, well, write it. Write what being a doula is to you and how would you share that with the world. And so I sat down, and my kids were only little, and I sat down every night at the table and wrote on my computer for I don't know, a couple of weeks, and came out with 3 days of the 5-day training, what I thought should be in there. And she said, yes, let's do it. So I started teaching at university for a company that was delivering doula training, which was actually brilliant, because starting, you know, teaching at uni was kind of so formal and unexpected, that anywhere that I've taught since has felt really quite informal and easy. Although, as you can imagine, I had them all in slipper socks rolling around on birth balls within about 2 hours of arriving. So it soon became less formal with me there. But, you know, that's the whole joy of being a doula, isn't it? We're not formal. We don't have lanyards. We don't wear uniforms. You know, that's what is so precious about our work, is that, you know, we can turn up in those places when people really need humanity to arrive. So anyway, that's how I got into it. And then from there, I did that for a couple of years, and then was invited actually by Doula UK to create my own course and put it through accreditation, which I did. And that was about 15 years ago now. And so I started doula training. And then from there, it just kind of, it just expanded into all sorts of other projects. And on the way, so many adventures unfolded, including discovering the joy of running residential doula training, and I was the first one doing it actually, and that was just magic as well. You know, hiring a house, we still do it actually, hiring a big space and having people all come and stay for a week, and so building this kind of pop-up community of doulas, and eating together and, you know, laughing together and inquiring together and growing together has been all part of the magic of teaching. I mean, you can't teach anyone to be a doula. I need to stress that, actually. You just can't. You can talk about all the tips and techniques, and you can talk about all the protocols and all the advocacy, and there are lots of things within that that you can teach, but the essence of being a doula is something that somebody kind of tends to already have. You know, it's an ability to serve, and it's an ability to listen really deeply, and I think that's something that's already there. So, yeah, so it just happened organically, and here we are still doing it. And hundreds of people now have come through the practice, and there's several of us facilitating now, because I couldn't do it on my own anymore.
Oh, amazing work, Kate. Think of all of those doulas that have gone out and helped made other people's births, like you say, that word about humanity, you've helped made other people's births more humane. And that's incredible, like the ripple effect of that. I've just gone all tingly just thinking how grateful I am that I did my training with you and met you and had you inspire me in my life, and what a huge effect you've had on all of us. It's incredible. Just to reflect that back and share that with you.
Can't help but notice that as you were talking about the community coming together and feeling that special connection, it made me think of our own lovely teachers community and how we definitely understand that vibe and how special and kind of indescribable it is in a way. You just have to experience it, rather, you know, and how it can really change people's lives. You know, I think sometimes with a training like yours and like ours, people go in to learn a skill or to be qualified, and actually they go away with a whole new perspective that then affects everything for them going forward in a positive way. So thanks for sharing that. I love the sound of your trainings, all about the slipper socks and rolling around on balls. Yes, please.
Excellent.
So Kate, what happened next? You know, conscious birthing was there. You've got all these doulas coming through, running the residentials, building that up. And then I'm sure probably in tandem, all these other projects and adventures were offshooting and spiraling and happening. What was it that actually happened next?
What I noticed was that a lot of the people coming through the training course had this real sort of revolutionary spirit. They wanted to change the world. And many of them went on to, you know, join organizations such as Birth Companions, working in Holloway Prison with women giving birth in the prison. and all sorts of different sort of social justice projects and whatnot that people are getting involved in. And I loved that. It made me really happy to think that that was happening. And I could never work out chicken and egg, you know, whether people like that were drawn to my training or whether there was something in the training that was kind of motivating that sort of revolutionary spirit in people. But in any case, I noticed it and I started wondering about how to harness that, because at the same time as noticing that, or within the same year or two, things had started to arrive at my table that were quite unique. So, for example, I would have a midwife friend get in touch with me and say, look, you know, a young couple have just been dispersed into your area and they're seeking asylum. They're younger than 20. They don't have English. And they haven't got a car seat, a Moses basket, any shoes, coats, or any support. Can you help? And of course, you know, to me, I was like, right, okay, writing a list and then off. And I remember there was one unique moment, actually, when a similar kind of list came through from someone, from a midwife friend. And I started at 8 p.m. that night. And by 9 a.m. the next morning, we had everything in place. And I just thought, hang on a minute. I know hundreds, possibly thousands of doulas across the world. Certainly in the UK, I know hundreds. And I know lots and lots of doulas that I've trained personally who are revolutionary spirited. And there's this massive need. There's this massive, massive need. And not just for people who are seeking asylum, but, you know, people who are without support, people who are without financial means, people who are without English, people who have been through complex and chronic trauma. How could we help? And then I thought, well, let's just see. I'll put the word out and see if there are any other doulas in the UK who feel like me, that I'd like to be able to do something. And within about 4 days, there were 70 people who had come forward and said, I'm in. And I thought, whoa, okay. Hang on a minute. what have I done? But in a good way, but slightly overwhelmed, you know, one of those happy overwhelmed moments. And so that was the beginning of Doulas Without Borders. And what's quite surprising about it to me is it feels like lifetimes ago. It really does. But it was actually only May 2019. So it wasn't that long ago. We're not even at 3 years yet. And Doulas Without Borders was born, really, as a voluntary organisation to support people who are or have been through trauma and are financially, you know, unable to hire a doula. Oftentimes, to be honest, the people that we work with have not even heard of a doula. So we are now 250 strong across the UK and growing literally by the week. And we work supporting people who are either with early on refugee status, asylum seeking, under 20, have been through sexual or physical or coercive violence or abuse, people with complex trauma. I mean, basically kind of anyone who's been right through it, who hasn't got support, and who we are able to support. And we work in teams, we work in small teams, and we now have a therapy department, an infant feeding department, and a language department. So we can call in a psychotherapist, we can call in an Albanian speaker, we can call in a, you know, lactation consultant, and form a team around that person to provide really quite cohesive care. So that's one of the projects that's been born, that's obviously quite a major one.
I was just thinking, wouldn't it be incredible to kind of have that structure of putting a team together to support that individual person replicated back into, you know, public health service systems like the NHS, so that people actually get the team that they need rather than a team that happens to be available that might not fit the brief. I think that's genius, Kate.
Is that all volunteers? So people just giving their own time to support people?
Yes, it is. It's totally voluntary, and that's an important part of our ethos, because what we've seen with lots of amazing small organisations around the UK who are also offering doula support is that funding, although funding is great, don't get me wrong, we do get little pots and we use it for education and this, that and the other, and DBS checks, and you know, all of our training is free. We've noticed that sometimes funding can be the thing that stops people prevents people from working in the way that they want to, because they have this remit that is, you know, they suddenly sort of almost become owned, and there's a hierarchy, and there's a, you know. And so I said, let's not do it. Let's not go and try and get £500,000, you know, for this. Let's get little bits of funding that still enable us to, you know, to roll out the training. Everybody gets DBS checked. Everybody gets safeguarding and vulnerable, you know, supporting vulnerable adult and child protection training, etc. But let's keep it voluntary and let's keep it unpaid in that regard, so that we are free to practice in a way that really speaks to us. And so we are unusual in that regard. I think that we're the biggest voluntary organization of doulas in the world, actually. And what makes it unique on the grassroots level is that, supposing, for example, really classic scenario, we find this all the time, a woman is going to hospital to give birth and she's living in a refuge, for example, and she has a toddler or two living with her. Now, just like you were saying, Claire, that, you know, the systems of care, in inverted commas, do not meet people where they're at. They do not have that relationship-based support. They are all at effect of the remit that they have to work within. So the woman who's going off to give birth in the hospital gets told, right, well, we're going to put your children into care while you go to birth your baby in the hospital. Now, how is anyone supposed to release a baby and relax and feel safe, knowing that their children are getting taken into care? So we will very often have a doula in the team who says, yep, that's fine for me. I will stay with the kids. That doula builds a relationship with the family in advance, so the kids feel really comfortable with her. She'll go around, she'll take some colouring or some stuff to do some baking or whatever, take them to the park, and be with the children while the woman goes off and is with another one of our team to have her baby. And those sorts of things on the ground make it, it's immeasurable the difference it makes to someone's life. So yes, long answer to a short question, we are voluntary, and for a very, very specific reason, we get to practice in the way that we think makes a difference rather than a funder's remit.
Oh, that's so interesting. And I can just imagine what a huge difference that would make to the woman you're supporting. Anecdotally, I've often noticed that those having their second, third or subsequent babies sometimes can't go into labour naturally if they're not feeling safe about what's going to happen with their eldest child. So I certainly know lots of stories of women who are kind of going quite far overdue and baby's still not around, perhaps they're getting to the point where they're going to be going in for induction, and then their mum or their sister or their neighbour arrives to just come and stay and offer support, and whoa and behold, bam, labour just kicks off, and it's like the body won't relax until the other babies are safe first. So I can imagine, you know, straight away just knowing that your children being taken care of already sets you on a better trajectory for birth to happen without intervention or needing extra right from the beginning.
It's that power of like love and community and support all coming together in a really stunning, stunning way. So again, I've had the tingles listening to you speak, Kate. So powerful. And how can people get involved with this doula collective? And is that what's called Doula Without Borders? Is this the name of the organisation?
Yeah, Doulas Without Borders is open to anyone who's a birth worker. And we have a very straightforward application procedure that's on the website. And by doing an application and then having an interview with me, you know, that's the start, that's the starting point. And then, you know, there's some training to go through and a welcome workshop to go through. And we have a wonderful reflective process. It's I always say, you know, the community that we are creating is as important to us as the community we are serving. So Doulas Without Borders is a really, although we're big, we're really close-knit, and we all kind of know each other a bit. And yeah, there's lots and lots of support for the doulas themselves. Even the, you know, the team of therapists, they also support the doulas. So they're not just there, you know, if you had a difficult experience as a doula within DWB, we can easily signpost you to one of our therapists or even a psychotherapist if you felt you needed that. And it's all free. So it's a wonderful organisation, and it's very easy to join and be a part of it. And people worry, you know, they think, oh, well, I might only be able to offer a couple of births a year for free. But then that's the power of numbers, isn't it? If there's enough of us doing that, then we are. I mean, last year, for example, we supported one birth a week for the whole of the year. And that's, you know, that's pretty amazing, I think. And by the looks of the trajectory this year, we'll be on maybe two or three a week. So it's wonderful, really.
That is phenomenal. Fast forward 20 years, and this will be the framework of birth.
Let's hope so. Definitely will be rolled out, you know, more and more. You know, I wanted to get the model just right before we went around the world, but obviously a bit like you know, the sans frontières, the doctors of the world, we also want to become a global community, and we had made steps towards that before the pandemic. We were about to partner with Spain actually, and we were all set up, and then the pandemic came along and everything has been massively delayed, but it will be a global concern in the end.
Phenomenal.
So how does this relate to your work with mother tongue? Would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So going along with DWB and seeing what positive difference we could make has been amazing. And I'm a real solution-focused person. So when I see a problem, I'm immediately looking at how can we work to fix it. And in this regard, what I was seeing time and again were incredible teams of doulas coming together to support women from all over the world who were coming to the UK to have their baby, well, coming to the UK and having their babies, maybe already in the UK, but without English. So sometimes it was without English as a first language, and sometimes it was without English entirely. And what I was noticing time and again was that it's really, really hard to advocate for someone and to protect their wishes if you don't share language. I mean, how can you do any of this? How can you even work out what their preferences are? And then I started to find out all of the layers that were underneath that. Like, for example, a person who is seeking asylum. Let's say they're, I don't know, let's say they're Somalian, seeking asylum, no English or very little English, and then they're going in to have their babies, and perhaps there's a DWB team or doula with them, and that doula recognises that the woman's not looking happy about the idea of having a vaginal examination. So that doula might be able to advocate for the woman and say, I'm not sure if she's happy with this, can you hang on a minute? But what we were discovering was that the woman herself would be so nervous about losing her right to remain that she wouldn't want to make a fuss. She'd want to be just like, yes, do whatever you want to do. I don't want to be noticed as being a troublemaker. I don't feel safe to stick up for myself. Or there's a cultural thing there where, I mean, there's so many different aspects to it. I mean, culturally, a lot of the people we work with have never, ever heard of having a midwife present at a birth. They expect a male doctor. So that in itself would be a shock. Then there's all the protocols and procedures that nobody can explain to them. And although there's supposed to be translators involved legally, you know, there's a legal human right there that says, you know, people who are going through a medical procedure in which consent is needed, which of course is any medical procedure, that by law you have to have somebody there to translate to make sure that that consent is for real. But we were seeing that this just was not the case. I mean, we see this isn't the case with English-speaking people, right? So you can imagine the mess for people who are already at disadvantage by lack of language, by lack of resources, by, you know, everything they've been through. So I started thinking, how can we fix this? And at first I thought, well, you know, maybe we could teach translators about how to be at a birth, because we were hearing many times that when translators were occasionally actually called out, and there's not enough funding for them to come as much as they should do, or they were there on the phone, they were useless. Often they were, not always, but often they were useless because they were men who were terrified at the sound of a labouring woman, or, you know, they were someone who didn't know anything about birth, or quite classically, you know, and I discovered this in my face at that point, that translators are trained to not notice nuance, whereas doulas are all about nuance. So whereas a translator will see that that woman is going, oh, no, I don't like the look of what's about to happen. And doulas will say, OK, look, hang on a minute, everyone. Can we just have 5 minutes? We need 5 minutes. Clear the room. I need to check in about this. The translator will, if the woman says yes, she just nods or gives any sort of acquiescence, that gets translated as a yes, because there is no nuance allowed to be noticed. So I thought maybe we could do that, maybe we could train translators, and then thought, no, that's just never going to happen, that's far too difficult. And from that idea, Mother Tongue was born, and I thought, you know what, the best thing we could offer would be if we could offer free funded training places to bilingual women and people who have been through, you know, extreme circumstances, who have been marginalized by those circumstances, who have got that lived experience and the shared language, and train them up so that they can then support the next cohorts coming through. Then we've got something really special. We've got an ability for them to be met linguistically and culturally, and for the doula to be trained in noticing the nuance and then advocating in a bilingual way from that place. So within Mother Tongue training, we've had some funding, we're on our third cohort, and we have a doctor of translation who comes in and teaches that element. She's also a doula, by the way, of 10 years. So she's got a wonderful ability to teach people how to be interpreting doulas. So we've kind of created a new model of doulaing. And as you can imagine, the Mother Tongue doulas then joined the language support department in Doulas Without Borders, and we suddenly have, you know, Swahili, Albanian, you know, all three different dialects of Afghanistan's languages, many languages, and they're all able to help in a very specific way. So
sounds absolutely brilliant, and I had never considered what it must be like for a translator whose job perhaps involves going into a courtroom or supporting, you know, maybe legal terminology or very practical problems, actually going into the birth space. I mean, they must be like fish out of water, really, in a lot of ways. So this makes perfect sense. And what an important gap that you're filling there, and what a change that could be. And, you know, when we think about birth ourselves, just as we were sort of talking about getting into a trance state or trying to, in a lot of ways, we want to leave language behind, really, and drop into the space where we're not thinking about what words we have to use, etc. That's an extra burden on that woman who, if she does have a little bit of English or, you know, trying to make herself known, how is she ever going to drop into that trance state? Well, someone who's there supporting her, who can take the few words she says and look at the whole person and the whole experience. What a gift that is, you know, or what a right it should be, really. But, in these circumstances, yeah, what a gift.
Absolutely. And do you know what's really interesting is that studies and research and whatnot have been done on this. And as ever, I found it through sort of grassroots, you know, through experience, and then found all the research afterwards, which I prefer that way around. Sure enough, when people go into that, into kind of deeply established labour, they lose their English. They go to their mother tongue. And it makes total sense, doesn't it, that your primal brain is awake. Of course you're not going to remember a learnt language. You're going to remember the language that you came in with, that your mother spoke in utero, that, you know, you learnt first off. And so it's fundamental for us to have the people around us who can speak the same language. So of course you can imagine with mother tongue, you know, that there are so many different languages all around the UK needed. So we can't always promise that in one particular area in Birmingham we're going to have a Swahili speaker who can jump in and support. So what we do is we create the team, as we always do with DWB. But if we haven't got somebody who can speak that language, then who lives down the road, then we come to our pool of language speakers, and that person will be on the phone through all of the meetings and through the birth and postnatally. Literally, the phone is just there on speakerphone, and so the doulas who are supporting have got immediate live language translation from another birth worker, which is important because of the terminology, because of the understandings about human rights, and because of, you know, all of the different factors that come in to play. So it's worked out quite coherently, and it's actually taking up quite taking up quite a lot of my working time now.
That must be so rewarding to see the difference that that can make to people. And I love the fact that it's mothers supporting mothers, or the people that were there first coming back to help the people coming up after them. What a beautiful approach, and what a powerful way to keep those communities connected, you know, and that time of where we can be so isolated and cut off, to have someone who's sort of almost like a mentor coming before you and being with you in that space, having experienced similar themselves, or, you know, I think that's just glorious.
It's so lovely. It's really, really lovely. And it's wonderful, you know, it feels like such cross-pollination, spending time training with, you know, people from all over the world. And we've got a training going at the moment, and there's, you know, we've got someone in Beirut, we've got someone in Tanzania, they're coming to the UK, everyone else is already in the UK. And, you know, we've got Syrian women, and we've got Albanian women, and we've got, you know, just women from all over the world. And what I love about it is that one of the things that we do, of course, because it's still got the essence of what I believe in as a teacher in the training, is look at our own blueprints. So I ask the women to find out what they can about not just their own birth, but what was their mother and their grandmother's story. So trying to look back and to reconnect with the culture before the damage. Because, you know, many, if not most of the people are coming from war-torn countries or places in which they've had to escape. And so the blueprint that's been left behind, if you like, or the more modern blueprint, is one of rupture and disassociation and fragmentation. But by spending time with the women, talking about how things were before, it's almost like reweaving the grandmother's stories and bringing back the thread. The mother line is healing the mother line. It's really, really powerful. Plus, we're all learning amazing things from one another, which is just magic, you know, it really is. But I love that aspect of it. It feels very powerful to be doing that with women, and really humbling work, actually. It just blows me away. I often come off the trainings and just have to just sit and, you know, in a place of absolute grace around it and thanks, because it's such an amazing, amazing opportunity. And the women, I mean, I hate to say it because it sounds just a bit trite, but they're so strong. Just blows my mind how strong women are, you know. The things that some of these people have been through, and the fact that they can find so much joy and so much connection, and they're so willing to take a risk and to, you know, to step out into something new. And yeah, they just blow me away. They're absolutely incredible, incredible humans that I'm very blessed to work with.
That's so wonderful. I'm wondering, as you hear these stories of cultures and the birthing line that came before, is there anything that you've learned about a particular culture that you thought, God, everyone should be doing this? What a fantastic idea. Why don't we do this in our births? Anything stand out for you particularly?
Yeah, there's so much. In fact, what I love is that the expectation and then when it's not met is as interesting as when it is. So of course you have this expectation as a white Westerner that you're going to learn this stuff from these ancient cultures that's going to blow your mind, and you're going to think everybody should be doing it. And what often happens is quite the reverse. So, for example, we were talking the other day, and we were talking about immediate postpartum practices and traditions around the world. And one woman said, oh, well, you know, after we've had the baby in our culture, we squat over on a potty. And I was like, oh, okay, do you put warm water in the potty? Yes, yes, yes. Ah, I said, okay, so you put herbs in the warm water, yes? She said, no, we put Dettol in the warm water. And I went, whoa, mind blown. And it's just, it happens all the time to me. I love it. And there I am again expecting that I'm going to learn about these ancient herbs, you know, and this incredible thing. And actually, they haven't got clean water. If they don't put Dettol in, they get really bad infections. That is their tradition. Thank you very much. So it's like, boom, you know, every time your Western perspective is just shoved into some new rhetoric that is, you know, mind-blowing. There was another one. I was in Senegal working with a traditional midwife years ago. It just reminds me of that, actually. And we were sharing ideas and practices, and we had a translator there who was actually one of her sons, who was a friend of mine, talking in Mandinka. And I went in and was, you know, expecting, like, the humble student. You know, this woman was in her 90s, still practicing, and I thought I was going to learn all this amazing stuff. And she got out this pair of rusty forceps that she was so proud of to show me. She had this, you know, amazing Western tool. And I was just, yeah, I was speechless, you know. But in positive terms, yes, there are many traditions. I mean, I love the Muslim tradition of silence when the baby is born, so that the Allah's prayer can be whispered to the baby and nobody else can speak before they hear the name of God. And I think, you know, if you applied that to whatever prayer, whatever words you want to bring in, that's such a powerful one. I love it, because you could do it with anything. And imagine, like, the Muslims can say very clearly, and they will be met, because they righteously should be, please don't talk. When my baby is born, it's very important that nobody talks. And then I whisper to my baby. It's actually usually the male member of the father or any other male member of the family. But you could have fun with that and make it your own, couldn't you? But just say, yeah, let's have that, right? We have to have silence. That's our religion. And this is going to be the first thing that we do with baby. That alone, I think, is just magic. I love it.
And makes sense if you view birth as a holy experience as well. Silence is perfect. It's in fact, that reminds me of my own birth story with my second. I had had an incredibly empowering home birth, and she had just come out, and I was holding my daughter, and I was looking into her face, and I had this overwhelming, the first thing that came to me is, oh, there you are, I've been waiting for you. And this kind of incredible moment, and to me it felt like a holy moment. And at the same time, my midwife is literally jabbering away in the background, sort of talking. And I kept going, shh, shh. And she obviously thought I was talking to the baby. I wasn't. I was talking to her. I was like, shh, this is my moment. This is my holy moment. Shut up. Because, of course, for them, it's an everyday experience. And I said to James, my husband, afterwards, I said, oh, why was she, you know, why was she chatting? He was like, I think she was trying to make sure you were okay. She was trying to get you to talk to her, to let her know that you were doing all right. And I was like, I was fine. I was bathing in my moment. And so, yeah, for me, and that, if that had been the cultural practice, I mean, wow. I don't, get me wrong, like you talked about with your birth story, although it wasn't always perfect or whatever, to me it still was perfect. And even the memory of the midwife jabbering through sort of makes me laugh, and brought with it its own learning, that you know, were I to support another birth, I might
And also, as well as the shush, like, think about, well, what is it that you'd like your baby to hear first off the bat? You know, your mother's words to your baby, what would you like to welcome them with? You know, that's going to be quite a moment. So maybe think about it in advance. I'm just thinking about it and it's like, I don't think I thought about it at all. I can't even remember what I said. And it's like, oh my God, I've lost the moment, damn it.
Well, that I've been waiting for you. I don't even know where that came from, but it was just so, it's there you are, I've been waiting for you, was the words that sort of straight away came through and the feeling that came through. And I don't know if you've seen Mamma Mia 2, but as she gives birth, that's the song that's going on in the background. And in the cinema, I just started bawling my eyes out while watching this birth, going, I was waiting for her. How did they know? My daughter still laughs when that bit comes in the film now, because she knows that it gets me all welled up and emotional. Yeah.
There's so many places for pausing, isn't there, in the birth story that we don't take. And I think we're kind of really obsessed with dilation and contractions, and it's all very like rah and quite yang and quite sort of, you know, expulsive. And actually there's so many, like, the points in between the contractions and the points, you know, I'm really into this whole notion of the birth pause where, you know, you don't have the baby just like slapped straight onto your chest by someone that you don't know wearing a pair of gloves, because it's just very weird. It's such a weird cultural thing to do, isn't it? And to take a moment to just pause and come back into yourself before you meet your baby can be really powerful. And that pause, I mean, that's just crazy that your midwife wasn't able to, again, you know, she's assessing your risk. So it's coming from a fear base. Oh, is Claire all right? Oh, I better check. Whereas actually trusting you in that place would have really allowed you to have that pause to just meet your baby, which is like, yeah, it's such an incredible moment, isn't it? It's such an incredible moment. It should not be taken away or diverted or anything. I like the idea of silence.
And I think listening to you, it's like the whole of our society is all, it's all about the doing, isn't it? The doing, the measuring, the assessing, let's do some more, let's be, let's do. And actually there's very few spaces where you can breathe out and be and just enjoy literally, you know, the smelling of the roses. And we need to bring that back into our cultural practices so that when we get it into the birth space, we're okay with just the being, with however it arises and unfolds. Can we drop into being and stop doing and measuring and checking and assessing and talking and just drop into the being?
So true. You know, it's funny, I say to people nowadays, maybe we should call ourselves beelers instead of doulas. Because it is, it's like people are like, what does a doula do? And it's like, well, actually, it's about learning how to be, you know, your presence is your currency in this work, you know. And that is quite challenging for people, as you say, because they're like, oh, even new doulas will go into births and start trying to do loads of things and get remedies out and clatter around because they feel like they've got to, you know, show their worth by what they do. And it's interesting trying to help people come back to a place of recognizing that the worth of being.
Powerful stuff. So many levels. So Kate, what else have you got coming up? We've had a really great chat about where this has all come from and what you've been doing, but what's on the horizon and what are you looking forward to doing in your work moving forward?
I'm really looking forward to next year. I mean, obviously more of the same is all great, and I'm loving the projects as they unfold. And as I mentioned, they're all still quite new, really. Doulas Without Borders and Mother Tongue. Mother Tongue's only a year and a half old. But next year I'll be working with Oxford University to do a piece of research to look at the impact on labouring and birthing women when they do not have interpreters to support them. And what's exciting about that piece of research is that it's got a level of implementation for change at the end of it. So it's not just going to end up as a sort of dusty piece of academia. It's hopefully going to be able to make a positive difference into the future. So I'm really looking forward to that. And I'm really looking forward to going back to roots in terms of offering some residential trainings this year. We've got a really great one coming up in June, and we've got a back in Brighton actually in July that's not residential, but just getting back into some in-person training because I've been doing a lot online in the last couple of years, as we all have, and I've loved it, and it has actually brought a string to the bow that I didn't expect, but I'm also really looking forward to getting back to some in-person training. So yeah, a bit of research, a bit of in-person training, trying to get some more funding for the next cohort of Mother Tongue, looking at perhaps focusing on East London particularly. So yeah, lots of things like that in the pipeline, more of the same and a bit of research thrown in.
Amazing.
Exciting stuff. We will watch this space and enjoy seeing more of your journey unfold. Is there anything you would like our listeners to know about going forward?
Yes, I think I'd like to just add thank you for having me on your podcast today. It's been really lovely to chat with you and to be given the opportunity to share, you know, some of my story and how it's all unfolded. And I'd really like to just add that, you know, we've got this kind of counterculture around the broken systems or the messed up systems of healthcare that we find ourselves in. And it seems to be, I've just been writing about it this morning, it seems to be all kind of free birth or bust, home birth, no pain relief, surrender to the sensations, trust your body, trust your intuition, etc., which is great and I'm all for it. But I work a lot with survivors and victims of violence and rape and, you know, lots of people who have been trafficked, for example. And actually, it just makes them feel like they failed again. It just makes them feel even worse to be told that, you know, having an epidural or a hospital birth or not feeling all right with the idea of surrendering to the sensations. I mean, most survivors are really uncomfortable with that notion. I just wanted to really perhaps finish on a note of caution for birth workers around some of these kind of meme type ways that we speak now to people, and to bring into awareness that it's not right for everyone.
Yeah, 100%, Kate.
And that's all about what you're doing, is looking at the individual in front of you and providing the right team and the right care for that person, and supporting them with their wishes and their needs. And that is going to look different for everyone. So at Lush Tongue, we've always believed that it's not how you birth, but how you feel about birthing that's the most important. So everything that we try to do is about empowering women to make the right choices for them. And that means sometimes stepping out of the guidance and assistance. And sometimes it means taking the things that are offered to you and doing so with confidence and empowerment. And so I think you're right. I think that sometimes we can get so passionate about supporting a certain type of birth, we forget that the power can be found in all types of birth.
Absolutely agreed. And there is one last thing I'd like to say, which is that I've developed a TIDE, which is Trauma-Informed Doula Education, which is an add-on. It's one of the foundational courses that we run through Conscious Birthing. And it's really, really good, I think, to start looking at those models of care, because we are in such a time of trauma response as a people now. And so to understand how best to support someone through a trauma-informed and responsive rhetoric is really, really useful. Here's to supporting everyone in the best way that they can possibly be supported, and encouraging them to find their own best way through rather than what we think is the best way through.
Yeah, absolutely. So Kate, we will absolutely add into the show notes links to all of your websites so people can find out more maybe about training with you, or some, if they need some support with their own birth journeys, we'll add all of that into the show notes so people listening can find all of that info. And then just to wrap up, finish off, maybe on a slightly lighter note, we usually do ask a couple of questions, and I know we've had a few emails back and forth because we both struggle with these questions sometimes. But just wondering, you know, in your own experience of being a doula, if anything's ever kind of struck you as as, you know, kind of not quite doula-ish about what you do, and if there's anything you might share about that at all. I'm a doula, but guilty confession.
Yeah, this question, this million-dollar question. Well, the thing is, Claire, there are plenty of things that I do that aren't very doula-ish, but I don't really do guilt.
Yay!
Guilt-free. I used to smoke roll-ups. I used to love smoking a roll-up coming away from a birth, you know, and I'd get in my car and I'd put on some really good music, and it was often when the sun was coming up, and I'd wind the windows down to stay awake, and I'd roll a cigarette, and I would enjoy smoking a cigarette. And that's completely un-PC and uncool and all the rest of it, but I had no guilt, and I still don't. I don't smoke anymore, but that's a little sort of, you know, undoulery thing.
Love it. Thank you, Kate.
We also have a belief that our children, each pregnancy, each birth brings with it perhaps a learning or a personality trait or something that we didn't have before. Now, when you were speaking about your birth experience with your son earlier, for me, that seemed so, the gift that he bought seemed so obvious to me, that he bought this absolute surety around your intuition, as if maybe you'd had your intuition before, but now that was going to be your leading guide going forward, and in fact has informed your whole career going forward. So what a gift he bought you. Do you think your subsequent children bought similar gifts or moments of clarity, or you found something about yourself that you didn't know before?
Yeah, definitely. My daughter, I have one other child, which is my daughter, and she's 2 years and a few weeks younger than my son. And the day that I found out I was pregnant with her was the day after my little brother died in a surfing accident. And so my daughter brought a very profound awareness from grieving and growing at the same time, that the joy and the pleasure and the, you know, absolute life of having, you know, two hearts and two heads and two, you know, all of that feeling of, you know, another body growing inside you. And I knew she was a little woman, I knew she was a girl, and I felt like a sense of connection to my grandmothers and a sense of connection in the mother line. And there was a sense of her being inside one of inside me as one of those little Russian dolls. It felt like that to me, but at the same time having this connection to death. And for me, it was a profound experience of the cycle of life and death, and the lack of distance between them, if that makes sense. The doorway, the fact that it's just a doorway, and one side's life and one side's death, but it's the same doorway. And to be able to experience that through my pregnancy was a profound gift.
That's really beautiful. It's almost as if two sides of the same coin, like this kind of can't have one without the other.
Yeah, there's no separation, really. It's all separation is illusion. And they're words that we hear, but I kind of got to live it. And I'm blessed by that every day. I still recognize that any moment of pain I have is just an illusory sense of separation from, you know, everything else. So yeah, that was pretty profound. There you go, you wanted to end on a lighter note. No chance.
Absolutely brilliant, Kate. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your time today. We really appreciate having you on.
Thank you so much for that invitation and for having me on today. It's been a real pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you, Kate.